Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust.
It is June 2021. Let's get into ASAP Now, the official voice of emergency medicine. On the cover of the June 2021 issue is an article by my friend and colleague, Dr. Lauren Westerfer, on outpatient management of pulmonary embolisms. That's right, sending them home instead of to the floor. And this is really something that I think has been slowly happening more and more. I think many of us do feel comfortable sending home a DVT on blood thinners. The question is, how about that PE? And with the direct oral anticoagulants, the DOACs, which some people call NOACs, the novel oral anticoagulants, but DOACs is probably better because these are direct inhibitors of the various pathways of clotting. And why call them NOACs, novel, when they're not that novel anymore? Novel is strange terminology when something's not going away. So they're DOACs. But with the DOACs, we can really start these patients on a safe anticoagulation regimen, and they don't need to be IV, they don't need to be bridged to therapeutic levels, and therefore we have guidelines from places like the American College of Chest Physicians and ASAP even that says that select patients with a low-risk pulmonary embolism indeed do not all have to be admitted to the hospital. Some of these folks can actually go home, and that's fantastic. And who are those patients? Certainly read the article, but I think that you can probably guess. You don't want to be guessing. You want to have a patient who meets certain evidence-based thresholds. This is where scoring systems or severity indices or criteria can be really helpful. And we have a table in the magazine with three of those exact tools. The first one, table one, is a pulmonary embolism severity index, or PESI score. And of all the scores, this is actually a score because you actually add up points. So for every different parameter, there's a different scoring system for it. So if they're older than 80 years old, then you actually add the age in years. And male sex, and having cancer, and heart failure, and chronic lung disease, and having a heart rate of 110 beats per minute or more, or having hypotension, which they define as a systolic blood pressure of under 100, being tachypneic over 30 or more breaths per minute, having a low temperature under 36 Celsius, altered mental status, and an O2 saturation under 90%. All of these give you various points on the PESI severity index, the pulmonary embolism severity index, PESI score. And if the patient has low risk, class 1, they're going to have 65 points or fewer, and those are your very low risk. And if you have 66 to 85, that's class 2, it's low risk, and so forth. And so you can use that PESI score. Those with a PESI score falling in class 1 or 2, they are potential candidates for outpatient management. And that's really nice because you can really know who those folks are. And a lot of it's intuitive. These often aren't patients who would be ones you're worried about. Quite frankly, if you end up with an old patient with hypoxia, you're done. They're not going to go anywhere. So it makes sense. A lot of these scores end up matching deep down what our gestalt would tell us. If you're just thinking that they're going to go to the floor, put on a monitor and put on a DOAC, maybe these are the ones who can do that at home. So the next one is the Simplified Pulmonary Embolism Severity Index. And that is the S-PESI. And that's really, you could call it a scoring system, but it's high risk or low risk. And low risk is no points, and high risk is one or more. And the risk factors there are, again, age over 80, having cancer, chronic cardiopulmonary disease, heart rate 110 or greater, systolic blood pressure, again, same as before, lower than 100 millimeters mercury, and an O2 saturation of under 90%. And in that one, What's simple about it is, like the PE rule-out criteria, the PERC score, it's not really a score per se. It's more of a tool that's off or on. If it's all check, 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 everything's good, zero, low risk. And if you fail for any reason, you get 1 point and one and done. It doesn't matter if they have three of them or two of them or one of these things checked off. Once you have a non-zero number, they are no longer considered low risk, and those are not the folks that you're going to be sending home, at least not using that tool. And then there is the third tool that you could think about, the Hestia criteria, and this is another quote-unquote scoring system, but really, again, it's all or none, because 0 points is low risk and one or more points is high risk. And I'll go through just briefly what the criteria are. They're a little different than the ones we mentioned before. The other ones are a combination of Wells criteria type of things, although the cutoffs are a little bit different, and PERC rule types of things, hypoxia, respiratory rate, pulse rate, that sort of thing. Whereas the Hestia criteria chucks all that into a couple boxes. So the unstable, that gets you a point, and therefore you are high risk. So hemodynamic instability, thrombolysis or embolectomy needed, that's a point. And I think that makes sense. I don't think anyone is going to be discharging a patient who just got thrombolyzed. So thank you, Hestia criteria, for that pearl of wisdom. Active bleeding or high risk of bleeding, greater than 24 hours on oxygen, or needed, that is higher than 24 hours on oxygen in order to maintain an oxygen saturation of greater than 90%. Again, not subtle. I think I'm admitting that patient. PE embolism diagnosed despite existing anticoagulant treatment. I think that's a not low risk PE, a higher risk PE. Severe pain requiring medications, like IV medications for more than a day. Medical or social reasons, of course. Creatinine clearance of under 30 mils per minute. Severe liver impairment, pregnancy, and history of HIT, heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. So any of those things in the Hestia criteria can be enough to take you from low risk, which is 0 points, to high risk, more 1 point or more. So all in all, we've got three tables here that you can refer to right there in the magazine. It was on the front page, but the meat of it really is on page 14 if you're going to open up your magazine and take a look at it, or online at ASAP Now, of course. And that really is going to help me document better, make some dot phrases as to who are the patients who I can discharge home. And I like to have a dot phrase to help me remind myself, not just for covering my ass in my chart, but also as a little reminder, oh, what is this patient's risk? So maybe I can send them home, or oops, maybe I shouldn't. So that's how I like to use my dot phrases in my charting, and I hope that I will adopt one of these soon, because I want to be doing the right thing for my patients, which is sending some of them, the low-risk pulmonary embolisms, home. Also on the front page of the June issue of ASAP Now is an article called Combating COVID in Latino Communities, and this is really a profile of Dr. Marina Del Rios Rivera. And this article really does a nice job of describing some of the outreach and the research skills that are out there that are trying to reach some really hard hit groups in the pandemic, of which the Latino community is certainly well documented to have been disproportionately affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is a great profile of one of the great leaders in our specialty, so check that out, please. Moving through the magazine, always like to check out what's going on. News from the college. During my time as editor, I think we've really tried to highlight some of the great things that ASAP is doing. So we talk about really controversial things like what the workforce group is going to do next. That's a big concern. This month, we introduced our first resident fellow, Dr. Cara Borelli, and that's really exciting because I think that this magazine needs the help we can get from the next generation of emergency docs. So we're going to have a yearly resident fellow. So congrats to Dr. Borelli for being our first. Very qualified among a very impressive group of applicants and finalists. I mean, unbelievable. The selection process ended up being a lot more difficult than I anticipated. Of course, I probably shouldn't have been too surprised. This emergency medicine is full of extremely talented people, and apparently really talented people who can write and edit. So I think it goes without saying that the future is bright, and we are trying to attract the best and the brightest to the college and the magazine. Next article I wanted to highlight was an article by my good friend Craig Spencer, MD, MPH. Dr. Spencer, you might know him from multiple appearances on television last year, really one of the go-to docs on the cable news circuit, if you will. And another reason you might know Craig Spencer is he sort of infamously or famously was the Ebola patient. He was the doc who actually got Ebola in New York. and did okay, but that was quite an ordeal for Craig. And I've gotten to know him over the past year and a half almost now. And what I didn't know, which probably should have been obvious based on the fact that he picked up Ebola during the crisis in West Africa in 2014, is that he is a major exponent for global health and for doing things the right way and really caring about helping people no matter what country they happen to call home. And so I asked Craig to write an article about why other nations other than the United States really deserve to have a lot of attention in terms of getting vaccinations. Now, this might not necessarily seem like an emergency medicine article per se, but I thought it was important to highlight that we increasingly have leadership in major organizations such as Doctors Without Borders, of which Dr. Spencer works, and others, where emergency doctors are actually increasingly seen as leaders. So I wanted to highlight the fact that there is a path for us to get involved in all kinds of ways. And this is a really great article about what we can do as Americans to support our colleagues around the world and donating surplus doses and how we prioritize that. And you might not agree with every single thing in terms of the way he lines it up. I agree with pretty much all of it, but I could see the arguments that people saying we got to look out for ourselves a little more. But I think that what Craig is saying is that we can do both. So we can definitely vaccinate ourselves while also doing the right thing and realizing that this crisis does not end until the world is actually vaccinated, not just here at home. So please check that out. That's Other Nations Deserve Their Shot, What the United States Can Do to Help Global COVID-19 Vaccination Efforts. Again, is this going to show up on your shifts? Not necessarily, but I do increasingly think that the public looks to emergency medicine as the sages, if you will, of all things medicine. And they look to us for advice. And what do we think? Because we're really on the ground. And I was said to Jerry Hoffman that my dream was that emergency medicine would be seen more than just the cowboys and in the pits of the ED, but also sages, the people who see the whole picture, because we really do have a really good view of the best things in medicine and some of the parts of medicine that could use a little work. Next up, did want to cover a great article by Jordan Grantham, who's one of ASAP's great staffers down in Texas. I work with Jordan all the time on lots of issues, especially on this magazine, and we were excited to have this article called ASAP for You, Committees and Sections Tackle Big Projects. One of the things that happens, let me just let you in on the sort of insider of being the editor of this magazine. What happens is that a lot of really great people or talented groups approach the editor. In this case, it's been me, and of course, my successor will deal with this too. And they say, oh, we want to have an article on ASAP Now. And it's actually not so simple because there's a page limit and we have to balance the number of ads with the number of content and all this considerations, and we can't edit a million articles because it's just a few of us working on this thing. And ultimately, we want to get the information out about what's happening, but we can't let everyone just like take out a free two-page ad like every time they do something. But we thought it would be great if we could highlight a little bit of a grab bag of what's going on in some of the sections. So there was a new clinical policy on opioids and pneumonia. So we want to remind people about that. That was from last year. And we wanted to mention that the ultrasound section had launched a new and improved sonoguide, which you can get on asap.org/sonoguide. And that this was really for people with not that much ultrasound experience, but also things that are on that resource that can help you expand your skills if you are a comfortable sonographer. Then you have from the ASAP Young Physician section and online education committee some great new content about kicking off your career. The EM Lifestyle series kicks off with career content. And so this is looking at career advancement, finances, life balance, parenthood, and many other great things that you got to think about early in the career. And we had an update from the EM Practice Committee led by Daniel Fries, a pal of mine who I think is still in Connecticut. And the ASAP Diversity, Inclusion, and Health Equity section had a webinar about vaccine hesitancy. This is Our Shot, How EM Docs Can Empower Patients to End the Pandemic. And of course, we covered some of that in the magazine, some of the take-homes from that. So a little double dipping there because that's an important one. So that was a really interesting one, as well as the ASAP Public Health and Injury Prevention Committee had a new initiative with some new smart phrases for things like related to coronavirus, which of course I'm interested in, so that was a timely one. And then the medical legal committee led by Roddy Vukmir, who is a doctor and a lawyer, in case anyone wants to be impressed. And this committee developed a new series of documents around EMTALA. And so check that out. There's a webinar, watch on demand, asap.org/EMTALA-webinars. Check that out. So love to have the grab bag to cover in little short hits what is going on with the committees and the various people working on those things. Speaking of getting involved, isn't it exciting that Leadership and Advocacy Conference, the LAC Conference, is going to be actually in person again this July? I wish I could attend. I actually cannot. I've got to do some other work, but I will be at ASAP 21 in Boston. So that's exciting. So that's another thing we highlighted, is that we're back in person. Also in the magazine is a Q&A with yours truly and ASAP president, Dr. Mark Rosenberg. And we talked about some of the challenges ahead of us, including the ASAP EM Physician Workforce of the Future report, which has turned a lot of heads. And certainly people are concerned and they don't know what to do, or they do know what to do and they want to tell you what to do about it. This is going to be something that will be talked about a lot in the coming months. And so I was interested to hear what Dr. Rosenberg thinks we ought to do. So please check that out. I love Dr. Rosenberg's upbeat sort of, gosh, he's so like friendly and, you know, just warm and makes you feel like he's just is good at making people feel good about emergency medicine. I think that's one of the reasons he got elected. But I also wanted to press him and say, look, man, what's going to happen? Like, what? These are tough challenges. So I think he answered some of the questions, but there are many more to be had. So check that out. That's my Q&A, my last Q&A with Dr. Rosenberg on page 8 of the June 2021 ASAP Now issue. Probably already in your inbox, maybe in your desk, somewhere else in your house. Maybe you find it in the lounge at work. Maybe you're checking it out online when you see it come across Twitter. We reach you in so many places. You can't get rid of us. We're like that. We're chronic. We are endemic. We don't give up because it's great stuff. Really continue to be proud of this magazine. I can brag about it because it's really a team effort. There's so many great emergency doctors and ASAP staffers who make this magazine happen. So something that we can be proud of because it's really for us, by us. And I think that's what makes it strong. Also in the magazine is part one of a three-part series on managing marine envenomations, which is called, wait for it, emergency medicine. Get it? Emergen-SEA-C, emergency. Anybody? No? No? I actually like the pun. I didn't write that pun, but I think that's an amazing pun. So anyway, this is part one of three. We cover some of the clinical manifestations of marine envenomations, and also anti-venom and how to treat some of these things. Do you need antibiotics? These three articles, of which this is the first, they're really consciously meant to be a resource, right? You may not read through it all at once. You may read it a little bit at a time. I just want you to know that they're there, and that if you go to the website or find it in your magazine in person, that this is a really great little right to the point, just cuts to all the parts you need. For example, do you put vinegar on a jellyfish, a Rakandi jellyfish exposure? Yes, you do. That one you do. And which ones need antibiotics and which ones are going to need anti-venom? So it's all right there. I think it's fantastic. So this is part one of three and a great resource. So check that out. In the EM Literature of Note section by Dr. Ryan Radecki, we've got a questionable new option for urticaria. There's a new IV medication out there that is maybe in our toolkit. It seems to work, but the problem is there may not really be a large group of people who actually need this, because most of them need something just to treat their symptoms, and oral medications are often just fine. So why add an IV if you're not going to add an IV? Obviously, we're not talking about patients who are going to get anaphylactic treatment. Those folks get IV. But for just straight up urticaria, like, should you be using this new IV form of cetirizine, which is now out there? So as we expect, Ryan Radecki is a little skeptical on that. Also in the magazine, The End of the Rainbow, this is by James Dahl. Dr. Dahl does investing and making sure that you don't do anything with your hard-earned money. We have responsibilities and we have to think about the present, the past, the future. And it's so easy to get sucked into the gambling of the market. But in this section, it's always very conservative and meant to help you consolidate what you are earning. And in Images in EM by Dr. Benjamin Thomas, we've got a Q&A with another doctor, Eric Anderson, who is an emergency doc and addiction medicine physician at Highland in Oakland. So that was a really nice Q&A. Please check that out. And as always, we've got some amazing pictures because that's one of Dr. Thomas's talents, is that he is an incredible photographer and also just combines that with some really interesting meditations and thoughts about what's going on in our field. Medical Legal Mind is always a little scary when you read these cases, but Dr. Eric Funk does a great job and always a lot to learn. Always really scary to go to work right after you read a medical malpractice case. I don't know about you, but when I read one of these cases, whether it's a case I'm looking at as a medical expert or whether I'm reading Medical Legal Mind in ASAP Now, when I go to work, I am like so paranoid after reading these. It's like going to work right after an M&M, but you're like so paranoid. And maybe in a good way, but maybe you got to be careful not to overdo it. Lastly, we've got a sound advice from a whole team of folks, but led by Aaron Nagdev, as always, looking at some micro skills of ultrasound-guided nerve blocks. And I think we have covered nerve blocks many times in this magazine, but I love these micro skills, so please check them out, because just a little bit of changing, like the angle of your probe, can make such a huge difference on whether that nerve block goes well or not. So I really enjoyed that. All right, we are totally over time here. Such an action-packed ASAP Now, and therefore a little bit of a action-packed ASAP Now cast. Lots of clinical pearls, lots of policy stuff going on. So wrapping it up here, thank you guys so much for reading, for being ASAP members, and for bringing your patients the absolute best care, as I know you do every single day and night when you work. So hats off as always, and see you next time.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.